This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the war in Ukraine could last years as low morale continues to be a concern among both Ukraine and Russian troops, AP correspondent Naomi Shane reports.
It's been 4 months since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and defense officials say desertions and armed standoffs between officers and their troops have led to a strain in morale, especially on the Russian side. Many Russian soldiers are said to remain confused about the war's objectives. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg admits that nobody knows how long the war will last, but urges allies not to weaken support for Ukraine, even if the costs are high, both in military aid and rising food and energy prices. I'm Naomi Shannon.
In recent days, Gazprom, the Russian gas company, has reduced supplies to two major European clients, Germany and Italy. In Italy's case, energy officials are expected to huddle this week about the situation. The head of Italian energy giant Eni said on Saturday, with additional gas purchased from other sources, Italy should make it through the coming winter. The U.S. Treasury Secretary addresses the possibility of an economic recession, AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
There it is, that R word again.
I don't think a recession is at all inevitable.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on the delicate dance being done by Fed Chair Jerome Powell as interest rates go up.
His goal is to bring inflation down while maintaining a strong labor market. That's going to take skill and luck, but I believe it's possible.
Yellen.
This is VOA News. New York is giving city workers fired for not getting the COVID vaccine a chance to get their old jobs back if they get the shot. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Mayor Eric Adams fired more than 1,400 city workers who failed to comply with the vaccine mandate put in place by his predecessor. A city spokesperson says about 600 unvaccinated workers, like police and firefighters, got a letter detailing the offer. Department of Education workers will get the same memo later in the summer. The city says 97% of workers are vaccinated and that the goal was always vaccination rather than termination. Adams was the target of criticism for exempting athletes and performers not based in New York City from the vaccine mandate while keeping the rule in place for private and public workers. Julie Walker, New York.
Firefighters in Spain and Germany struggled to contain wildfires on Sunday amid an unusual heat wave in Western Europe for this time of year. The worst damage in Spain has been in the northwest, regional authorities said, while German officials said that residents of three villages near Berlin were ordered to leave their homes because of an approaching wildfire Sunday. Spanish authorities said that after 3 days of high temperatures, high winds, and low humidity, some relief came with dropping temperatures Sunday morning. At least 25 people were killed by lightning or landslides over the weekend in Bangladesh, while millions were left stranded or homeless in lie-lowing northeastern parts of as the country faces the worst monsoon floods in its recent history, officials said. In the neighboring Indian state, at least 17 people were killed during the wave of flooding that began this month. Police officials said on Sunday many of Bangladesh's rivers have risen to dangerous levels and the runoff from heavy rain from across Indian mountains worsened the situation, said the head of the state-run Flood Forecasting and Warning Center. Bangladesh and India have experienced increasing extreme weather in recent years, causing large-scale damage. Environmentalists warn climate change could lead to more disasters, especially in low-lying and densely populated Bangladesh. Recapping our top story, British defense officials assessing the intense fighting in the Donbas region of Ukraine bordering Russia say morale among troops on both sides is likely growing troubled. Meanwhile, NATO's chief is warning the fighting could drag on for years. In an interview published on Sunday, NATO General Secretary Jens Stoltenberg said, quote, "Nobody knows how long the war could last. We need to be prepared for it to last for years." Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clothier in Washington, D.C.
All which I've been saying is that let us reset the country. Let us throw away the old ways of doing things. Let us move Nigeria from consumption to production. Let us get our youth engaged, and let us give government back to workers and to the youth.
In Nigeria, the presidential candidate for the opposition Labour Party, Peter Obi, names his campaign director general, Doyin Okupe, as his interim running mate.
I once worked for State House, and I resigned, and I was that time being labeled as pro-opposition. This is the opposition now in government. That tells you that I stand on behalf of Malawians, the voices people that are literally struggling. Millions of people are currently struggling.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera cancels two trips abroad as he invokes new austerity measures.
We have good example in some villages on how people live together and how the fact of hosting refugees in a welcoming environment is also, you know, benefiting the entire population.
The international community celebrates World Refugee Day on June 20. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, Peter Obi, the presidential candidate for the opposition Labour Party, has named Doyin Okupe his campaign director general as an interim running mate. The move, Okupe says, is aimed at meeting provisions of the Electoral Act. They demand that presidential candidates name their respective running mates by Friday, June 17. Analysts say Obi, a former governor of Anambra State, is generating support among the youth. Young people are rich, critics say, mainly on social media platforms. They also say that they often don't register or show up to vote on election day. Meanwhile, Okupe says the Labour Party is in talks with other opposition groups to form an alliance ahead of the elections. He, however, added that their talks neither include the ruling All Progressive Congress nor the main opposition People's Democratic Party. For more on Obi's choice of running mate, I reach Doyin Okupe.
It is factual, it is true. We had to come to that decision because, you know, we were new in Labour Party. We are just about 3 weeks old in Labour Party. And that has not given us enough time to be able to have the reach that we require to take a definitive decision on who the vice president will be. Besides that, we are in talks with so many other parties and so many other groups and youth formations nationwide. And we do not want to preempt the possible outcomes of such discussions, you know, so that people do not feel that, you know, we've had everything sealed and dried before they arrive. We'd rather have the table full and then we take a joint decision so that everybody is carried along. So in the meantime, the electoral law states that, you know, by Friday 17th, you know, all applications and nominations must come in. So, you know, it became inevitable that somebody has to stand in for this position in the meantime, and that is why I was considered.
Let's talk about the ongoing discussions with other parties with the intention of forming an alliance in the run-up to the next year's election. Will that include the ruling APC and the main opposition PDP parties?
Not at all. Those are the people that we are confronting. Those are the people we want to take power from. So we're going to put up a coalition of Labour, the NLC, the working class, the PRP, the NLPP, the SDP, majority of the political formations that are available, and various stakeholders into a big national political coalition. This is what we put up in good stead to be able to confront and subdue either of the two parties.
A lot of people have cited Obi of generating a lot of support from the youth especially on social media platforms. And they are saying that his support appears only to be on social media platforms and not a reflection of what is happening on the ground. What are your thoughts?
That is a fallacious statement. It is untrue. Your big phenomenon and your big movement have gone beyond social media. You know, it is involving everybody, majorly youth, and even parents are joining now. Most people in Nigeria who want a resetting of the country, who want a change for good in the country, who want a new dawn for Nigeria, are joining the OB movement. And it's a nationwide affair. It's nothing limited to the social media.
Governor Peter Obi is calling on the Nigerian youth to take their country back, in his own words. Some are also saying he's stingy and not a politician that Nigerians usually have by spreading a lot of money to grease, so to speak, people's arms to get some quantitative vote to win elections. What's your reaction when you are hearing all these?
One of the things that appears to be for most Nigerian youth and electorate is the fact that they believe that he's not profoundly good and that he is prudent in his management of his own even personal financial affairs, and has proven that even in public, in the management of public funds, he has a record that is almost unrivaled. Haven't been able to leave about 75 billion naira in the coffers of the government after 8 years of being a governor. So, this is what is driving his popularity. It is also coincidental that Obi is coming in at a time when poverty are eating deeply into the fabric of Nigerian society. Majority in our over 100 million people who are poor in the country. That is close to 50% of the country. About 60% of our youth are unemployed. All right? And so all these difficulties and difficult situations are making people to be amenable to the policies and ideas that Peter Obi is spreading. All Peter Obi is saying is that let us reset the country, let us throw away the old ways of doing things, let us move Nigeria from consumption to production. Let us get our youth engaged, and let us give government back to workers and to the youth.
Doyin Okupe is the interim running mate of presidential candidate Peter Obi. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, recently announced that he has cancelled 2 trips abroad as part of a new austerity measures. Foreign Minister Nancy Tembo says the move will save taxpayers about $262,000. The decision, she says, sets the tone for the new period of budget cuts. Addressing the media, Tembo says the president delegated 2 cabinet ministers to attend the OPEC Fund for International Development Conference in Vienna, Austria, scheduled for June 21. She adds that she will represent the president at the upcoming 2-day Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting scheduled to begin in Kigali, Rwanda on June 23. But critics and civil society groups say the president should do more to cut down on public spending to, in their words, help cushion the impact of tough economic conditions. For more reaction to the president's trip's cancellations, I reach Sylvester Namiwa. He is the executive director of the Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives.
It is coming too late when the damage has already been caused. As I'm talking to you now, Malawians are literally struggling to make ends meet. Now they are questioning the morality of the president of asking everyone to tighten their belt when actually he is the spending in opulence.
But Namiwa, last time you held a news conference, you called on the president to cancel international trips, and that would save taxpayers' money. This time around, the president has listened to the people. He has also tightened his belt, canceled 2 international trips, assigned people. Why is this not important to you?
Mind you, President Lazarus Chakwera and his Tonse Alliance government have mastered the art of saying one thing and doing exactly the opposite. Because in the first place, there's no evidence whatsoever that he was supposed to attend to those functions. By the way, we have got envoys, we have got representatives, we have got ambassadors and high commissioners that are supposed to be attending to those meetings. Closer home here, we have John Pombe Magufuli, who transformed the face of Tanzania in a space of 6 years without going outside Africa. We want this kind of a leader. In fact, we are asking him to do more by trimming his cabinet from 32 to 20. He should chop his crowd of advisors from 22 to 5. There is no just special whatsoever why the president who has got a cabinet of 32, he should have 22 advisors. Our economy cannot sustain that. Malawians are struggling, my brother. I wish if you were here, you could have shed tears. People, it's not a matter of having disposable cash now. It's a matter of going into shop with a dilemma, whether you're going to get the basic need you want. Shops are rationing essential commodities, for example, sugar and cooking oil.
The president has a team that has to work with him. Previous administrations have had bigger cabinets than he has. He has reduced his cabinet, his supporters say. So what more do you want him to do? Malawi has to function, by the way, irrespective of the prevailing economic challenges that people are facing, as you said.
Muzubanda uses to govern this country with 12 cabinet ministers. My brother, economy cannot sustain 32 cabinet ministers. The president should have done more. And now what we are asking is, all those savings we are making, the president should create a special vehicle to ensure that they should be transferred to cushion the marginalized and vulnerable people that are literally struggling. Yes, we welcome that party is answering our calls, but then the president should do more to meet the reality on the ground, not a mere PR stance.
President Chakwera delegated Minister of Energy Ibrahim Matola and Minister of Water Obida Maya to represent him at the OPEC Fund meeting, while Minister of Foreign Affairs Nancy Tembo will represent him at the Commonwealth meeting in Rwanda or Chogum. These are important places where he has delegated people instead of him going, saving over 200 or approximately 260 million kwacha of taxpayers' money. Some people said he should
My
be
brother, we need to go a step further. Why do we have ambassadors, high commissioners? Why do you have diplomatic missions? The president should even stop delegating these cabinet ministers. Let ambassadors represent him if it is very critical.
But the president is the chief ambassador. He is the chief foreign minister. Why shouldn't the president say it? Because there are
not
allowing.
Not at this time when we are literally begging the IMF. Not at this time when we have started rationing essential food and products. Not at this time when the companies have started closing down because of scarcity of foreign exchange. Not at this time when the president has not delivered any of his promises. The president should stay in office. If there are critical meetings, he should attend virtually. Thanks to the advanced technology, we are no longer in the dark age. The president should use every means possible to attend such important meetings, and the sure way of doing so is attending the meetings virtually.
But this is what people are saying, that you are just playing peer near politics in favor of the opposition party to score cheap political points.
My brother, I don't believe democracy is about holding leaders to account for their actions. They are just doing that deliberately to divert people's attention. My brother, I don't belong to any political party. In fact, I once worked for State House and I resigned, and I was that time being labeled as pro-opposition. This is the opposition now in government. That tells you that I stand on behalf of Malawians, the voices people that are literally struggling. Millions of people are currently struggling.
Sylvester Namiwa is the executive director of the Center for Democracy Economic Development Initiatives. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. The global advocacy group Refugees International has appointed Abdullahi Halaki as a senior advocate for Eastern Southern Africa. Officials say Halaki is an African policy expert who brings to the organization decades of experience in displacement, conflict, human rights and strategic communications. He is expected to report on the need for better policies for displaced people in the two regions. For reaction to his appointment, I reached Abdullahi Halaki.
I'm excited to start on this position at a time when the need for people who are displaced, people who are refugees, is probably at its highest. And working with an organization like Refugees International that is at the sharp end of trying to find solution to some of the most persistent and urgent problems around displacement and refugees was something that I was very excited about.
What, in your experience, do you think you can bring to Refugee International?
In terms of experience, I have worked at, you know, in that region for the last over 10 years now, either as, you know, as an analyst working with the International Crisis Group or as a human rights researcher working with Amnesty International or as a policy officer with the International Rescue Committee. All those areas of work, whether it's conflict with refugees and humanitarian, and as well as egregious human rights violations. So that is the kind of experience having worked in not only the thematic areas that I've explained, but also being in some of those countries in the region. I've worked in Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, Somalia. All that, what wraps around really is my strategic communication. You know, I was trained as a radio producer in my previous life before I embarked on, you know, working on public policy.
What are your expectations about your new assignment, especially during this period of, you know, experiencing the impact of the Russia invasion and inflation, which are battering economies of countries and having a toll on humanitarian organizations such as Refugees International?
All areas that Refugees International work on are areas that are urgent. But in the area that I work on, in the region that I work on, the current crisis in Ethiopia that is entering its second year in November, and since the blockade, you know, almost 1 year this month, I think those are the areas, those are the two, that's one country that there will be a lot of focus in trying to figure out how to unlock the current, you know, limited and in some cases really, really, really difficult humanitarian access situation that we have in the country. And the second part is the kind of, you know, crisis that we are seeing with respect to really difficult climatic shock-induced food situation. You know, you're looking at the countries in the region, be it Kenya, Somalia, as well as Ethiopia. The level of, you know, food insecurity is absolutely difficult. And so focusing on some of these issues, bringing them to light. And, you know, as you know very well, the United States government has been a generous in terms of funding some of these humanitarian crises. But really bringing some of these things to be will be something that I'm looking forward to. Another, you know, that these 18.4 million figures could rise to 20 million. And that is really, really difficult. You know, nearly 500,000 people across Somalia and parts of Ethiopia face famine-like condition with women, children, particularly the most vulnerable.
What should be the expectations of people in East and Southern African regions who benefit from Refugees International's work?
The expectations is that we will be able to highlight, you know, unlike other, you know, organizations in this space, what we do is, you know, high-level advocacies in global capitals, including here with the UN and other agencies. We are also doing advocacy in some of, you know, regional capitals with various organizations there. So I think that is what they will expect, you know, robust production of empirical research and reports that are based in, you know, field work. That is the kind of work that we do. And we use those reports, blogs, podcasts, campaign to be able to raise the profile of some of these issues and for people to pay attention to, particularly the policymakers here and elsewhere.
Abdullahi Halaki is a newly appointed senior advocate for East and Southern Africa for Refugees International. He spoke with me from here in Washington. A number of refugees in Uganda are taking on skills training opportunities to start their own businesses and support their families. The majority say this is a way to survive after their failure to join the country's labor market. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Following his departure from South Sudan, Joseph Asu did not return to school while living in Ugandan settlements. Instead, he concentrated on looking after his young siblings. But as life got harder in Chilandongo settlement, Joseph was introduced to a skills development program which taught him to make local foods, including a crunchy Ugandan snack called Daddy's.
I went there, I didn't know anything. But when I reached there, I learned chapati, I learned cakes, I learned cookies, then I learned Daddy's. And among all those, I picked chapati and the donut.
After 6 months in the program, Joseph's plan is to set up a bakery.
Because I've seen there is a high demand. Whenever I'm in the market, very early in the morning, people are supplying bread from Biali using motorbike to they come here. That is my business, so that I can able to supply people with the food.
Esther Amol is another South Sudan refugee in Chilandongo settlement. She says a number of people there have gained skills while in the settlement. They have been able to set up micro enterprises from which they earn money and provide food for their families.
These dropout girls or young women, they can actually still continue their learning in terms of vocational. They give you the skill like tailoring, and once you have that skill or knowledge, no one can take it away from you.
Nakate Christine is the program coordinator of a skills development project in Chilandongo refugee camp. She says the Ugandan government and partners provide for their basic needs, but they need development skills to reduce their over-reliance on humanitarian aid.
We are doing skilling through three models, which is apprenticeship, micro-enterprise, and vocational trainings. And each of these approaches has 120 beneficiaries. The whole total is 360. The trades that were taken, they were trained through catering, bakering, welding, hairdressing, tailoring, motor repairs, electronics.
However, some refugees feel left out of skills development programs. In Changwali settlement, refugees who come mostly from the Democratic Republic of Congo are asking for vocational instruction to acquire skills and become self-reliant. Joseph Bamwenda resides in Changwali.
Most of my brothers and sisters end up dropping out and you find them starving. But if they are to bring vocational school, me, I think people can, they go, they learn, they be equipped with skills, so they hope they be that they get a good future in their life to come.
Hilary Onek is Uganda's Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees. He has appealed to partners to give the country a hand in providing both the refugees and host communities livelihood and relevant skills for labor.
This program definitely of skilling the youth is not only for the refugees, but even in those areas where they've settled, particularly in northern Uganda, this has been lacking as well. So a lot of our young people, after dropping out of school, they don't have viable skills in order to earn livelihood.
Skills and vocational training has been identified as the most cost-effective way to increase employment for refugees in a country that is already grappling with high numbers of unemployed people, especially youths. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Sources say North Korea has so far this year conducted 31 missile tests. Now there is concern that the Kim Jong-un regime is preparing for its first nuclear test since 2017. This is Rick Pantaleo, guest host for Encounter. On our next edition, my expert guests will update us on North Korea. Listen Saturday and Sunday for Encounter on the Voice of America.
This
is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, on June 20 of each year, the international community celebrates World Refugee Day. On this occasion, attention is focused on those who have fled their countries, often due to violence or joblessness. The Republic of Congo is one such nation. More than 200,000 people fled the Central African Republic to Congo-Brazzaville after armed conflict broke out in 2013 when an armed group seized the capital of the CAR, Bangui. VOA Rosie Pio has the story.
Guillaume is single and the father of five. He fled war in his home country, the Central African Republic, for the Republic of Congo in 2015. After obtaining his official refugee card from the UNHCR, he now struggles for his daily survival and for family members who are his responsibility. He says that he left the CR during the events that took place there and came to Congo. He says that the Congolese people gave him a warm welcome, and since then, he and his family have managed to live by doing small jobs here and there. Like Guillaume, about 2 million people from the Central African Republic have fled the violence for refuge in neighboring countries. Nearly 2,000 are now in the Republic of Congo. Anna Elizabeth Reveto is the UNHCR representative in the Republic of Congo. She says she's thankful for the support for refugees given by government, civil society, and host communities.
In the Republic of Congo, you know, the refugees are living with host population. They're living together. And it's a very good example of populations living together. And we are fighting these old ideas that refugees are set aside in specific sites for them in camps. We're really emphasizing on the need for refugees to live together with the local population. And this is what most of the refugees are enjoying here in Congo.
Haveto says the success of integration effort in part of the Republic of Congo.
And we're really working at attracting attention to the needs of all population in those areas, because they're mostly living in the north of the country, in the Lekwala department and in the Plateau department. So we have good examples in some villages on how people live together and how the fact of hosting refugees in a welcoming environment is also, you know, benefiting the entire population.
This Saturday in Brazzaville, refugees from all parts of the Republic of Congo will gather in the capital, Brazzaville, to sell their handicraft, an important way to announce their survival. For VOA Africa, Rosie Piot in Brazzaville.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last Friday, in a wide-ranging speech before the St. Petersburg's Conference on Investors, President Xi Jinping of China made proposals on the challenges and opportunities facing the international community. In that regard, he proposed inter alia that emerging nations should play a greater role in the decisions relating to money and finance in the global community. This proposal by President Xi Jinping is really not new. It has always been the abiding goal of the Global South. At the end of the Yom Kippur War of 1973, Arab and African states, oil-producing states, proposed radical changes in the price of a barrel of oil. The dramatic rise in prices caused major dislocation and surprise to the developed countries, mainly in Europe and the United States. It caused a radical turmoil in the oil markets. In that situation, Algeria, a member of the Organization of African Unity and the Arab League, made a proposal to the General Assembly that the issue of the IMF and the World Bank should be discussed. The proposal was called New Economic Order. And by that proposal, the General Assembly will be able to propose guidelines and rules under which the Bretton Woods institutions, again the IMF and the World Bank, should take decisions. The purpose was to circumvent the existing situation in the IMF and the World Bank. In contrast to the General Assembly, where you have one country, one vote, in both the IMF and the World Bank, decisions are taken by weighted voting. And in those situations, the Global South has minimal influence in decision-making. The debate in the General Assembly on new world economic position went for about a decade. It came to an end at the Economic Summit Conference in Cancun, Mexico, at the beginning of 1982, when President Reagan of the United States made a definitive position of the United States clear. He asserted that the U.S. would not support any proposal under which the General Assembly will set the rules and the regulation for the World Bank and IMF to operate. The Global South states left Cancun dejected and frustrated. But that really was the end of the debate of new economic world order. After years have elapsed, the Global South also turned its attention on the leadership of the Bretton Woods institutions. Under the existing rules, the IMF leadership is determined by the European states, and the World Bank leadership is determined by the United States. It was therefore proposed that these leadership positions should be rotated. The West joined the debate and appeared to show some flexibility. But after a long disappointment, it would seem that the existing situations could not be changed, and we still have the Europeans determining the leadership of the IMF and the United States determining leadership of the World Bank. This is seen by the Global South as giving preponderant influence to the Western countries. Perhaps it was this situation which compelled some states to form a new group to bypass the preponderance influence of the West in the Bretton Woods institution. This group is called BRICS. This is for the membership of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They sought to find ways and means for them to make decisions on economic global decision. Right now, today, a major meeting of the BRICS is taking place in Beijing under the chairmanship of President Xi Jinping. And now that we see the impact of sanctions which have been imposed by the West in reaction to Russia's war in Ukraine, questions have been raised as to how to meet these challenges and what are the opportunities. Perhaps at the conclusion of the current meeting of BRICS in Beijing, we may have an answer. But in the meantime, many members in the Global South are seeking ways and means to become full members of BRICS. Argentina has been the most vocal. Nevertheless, many people believe it may be very difficult. So there is a divergence of views whether creating alternative payment system as now exists in the West to an other system or changing the rules of the game is possible or even effective. In the final analysis, African states should not hesitate to cooperate with those in this Global South to discuss the proposal put forward by President Xi Jinping. This will be vital to their future development. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
yo sé tu nipón. Muy hacia el teléfono en vez de atrap. Pasa lleno en su plena tonquera. Yo sé tu papi, con todo tu telam. Même pas si de tout ces cas fédéral. Car je t'attends, c'est pour moi. Assez parlé. Tout ce que t'es moi, je veux partager.
Make me shiver. Now, coupenda, bring your body.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a bird that allows itself to be caught will find a way of escaping. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.